When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com. Code program.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Phileas Club, a show where we get people from different parts of the world to tell us how things have been going in their corner of this planet. We usually get people from actually different places, different countries, but today we are following up on the gripping saga that we started all the way back in, when was it, 2019, maybe? We are having a Brexit saga episode. And I think I'm going to keep with the tradition now, or I guess it's three before it can be a tradition. So this is the second episode that's going to have a subtitle. It's not just numbers, you know, when you go high enough on sequels, the numbers become more of an impediment because it's like people feel you have to have listened or to have played the previous games or watched the previous movies. So then they put a subtitle, and our subtitle last time was The Kerfuffle. It was just before Brexit was actually going to happen, and there were some issues. This time, Brexit has happened, and so I think the title is going to be The Aftermath, which I think is worthy of the epicness of what's happening in the UK. My name is Patrick Beja, and already we're seeing the cracks, the devastating effects of Brexit in that it has devastated our panel, and neither Bart nor Alex could make it for this episode. But it's okay because we're left with the best. We are left with Bruce. With Bruce, you know, they're not here, so they can't really object to anything.
That is true, yes.
Bruce and Gareth, can you reintroduce yourself for what is the first episode of 2021? Bruce, how's it going?
Hi, Patrick, and hi, Gareth. I'm Bruce. I live in Scotland, and I'm very, very, very anti-Brexit. But you know, Brexit's happened, so it's like being anti, I don't know.
Anti the sun.
It's already happened.
I don't know. It's like the sun must go. That's it. Hey, yes. Gareth, how are you doing? You must be on cloud nine. You got everything you wanted out of life. Gareth? Except the mute button.
I didn't get the mute button. I'm Gareth.
Wow, you're clipping very much still. We thought we fixed it, but you're. Can you reduce the gain again, and I'll manage the volume from here.
Sorry. Yes, I will do that.
So
it needs to go down further.
You know what? Just before you do that, I'll tell you a little bit about myself. Not you, Gareth, but the audience. We will be talking about... So what happened today? I woke up at 4:30, couldn't go back to sleep. I'm a little bit sick because the little one has some kind of a cold, not even a flu. It's a little thing, but I have a little bit of sniffles and I feel tired and I have a headache. Woke up early. It's been snowing, like, I think it snowed 30 centimeters, which is a lot. It's like, what is it, 15 inches in essentially 24 hours, and it's still snowing. So I went out to clear the stairs and the car, and it took me half an hour just to do that. It like, I don't especially like snow, and that's why I came to live in Finland. Makes complete sense. But it was pretty terrible. And also, yes, Brexit happened, and the president of the US is inciting armed insurrection in the capital, which we will talk about at some point in 2021, probably before the end of the month. But today we're not talking about that. We're not talking about how I am incredibly tired. We're talking about Brexit. And we're doing so with Bruce and Gareth. Again, Gareth, how's it going?
So hopefully my gain's turned down quite a bit now, and I'm sounding okay? Or do I need to go up a little bit?
You're sounding okay. Gains-wise, it's still a little bit clippy, but the volume I'm raising on this end, so we'll go with it.
That's fine. Okay, so sorry, I'm Gareth, and I'm the resident Brexit fanboy, I guess. I should be sitting here in a position where I'm absolutely ecstatic with joy, because everything appears to have gone exactly as I, in theory, wanted it to, and all seems to be good and nothing's broken. Trade still appears to be going, and we have a deal. It may not be the deal that everybody wanted, but it's definitely a deal. I think everything's okay with the world, generally.
So this is something I want to spend a little bit of time on, Gareth, because when this started happening 2 years ago, was it 2 years ago? It feels like a million, but let's say 2 years ago, roughly, it was impossible. It was a laughable question that was being asked of the in British people. And even after the vote happened and it was decided that you would actually exit the European Union as a country, not just you, Gareth, you're taking everyone with you. It still seemed like, yeah, but it's not really going to happen, is it? And now it has. It must, like, this is lifetime level achievement for, well, achievement if you wanted it, for the British people. Do you feel any of that? I don't want to say pride, but you feel like you've fought for something, and, well, you voted. That's, I think you're not like a militant activist, so you voted, but you were for it, and it happened. How does that feel?
I think it feels, from my point of view, it feels good, and I'm glad that we've managed to do this, and that we appear to have managed to do everything in an orderly fashion. I wouldn't have wanted to be in a position where I felt that the government had sort of promised something or had offered something that really genuinely was completely impossible. I know we had the, you said about the talking monkey, which I think is an absolutely fantastic way of looking at it. That's stuck with me from that. I think that was the first episode we did. We were offered something. It turns out, okay, it might have been difficult, it might have been tricky, and it might not have been completely achievable. But we've managed to get a monkey that's able to understand.
Maybe it does sign language.
Yeah, a sign languaging monkey or something. Close to a facsimile of a picture of a talking monkey rather than an actual one. I don't know.
I have to say, we don't have Bart, our resident Irish, on the show today, which is too bad, because the talking monkey part is specifically the issue with Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, and how it relates to trade and the way it works with the UK and with Europe. And I don't know that is resolved, but I'm not going to speak too much about it because I have, I don't have a expert knowledge on it. I don't know that it completely works, but I'm sure we'll have other opportunities to talk about it. But you seem, I don't know how to put it exactly, but it feels like that's something I've been feeling for the past, ever since the fervor about it has died a little bit for the pro-Brexit camp, or at least that's how I perceived it. You seem like you are feeling, yeah, okay, we did it. Awesome, cool, whatever, kind of. And the people who are opposed to it or who didn't want it to happen are devastated. And there's a very clear to me kind of unbalance between not how much you wanted it and how much they didn't want it, but how happy you are about it, like how important it is for you and how important it is for them, if we can even put it in terms of, you know, us and them, which I understand is not very productive. But does that make sense, Gareth? Or is it just the way you speak in a mild British manner that gives me that impression?
Well, I think, I mean, even amongst British people, I think I am generally considered to be fairly unflappable, I think is probably a good term. You know, I don't tend to panic and I'm not prone to hyperbole. But so I think generally I'm fairly matter of fact about this sort of thing. And I kind of, yeah, you know, it happened. It's what we voted for. They've managed to do what, as far as I can see, appears to be a pretty good deal. Or the best deal that we could expect. And this is, you know, this is not going to be the end of it. Obviously, you know, we've said all along, this is very much the start. You know, we've hit the end of the 1 year transition period. We've had a few problems on the border, but I think most of those problems have actually been related to that word that we're probably not going to use because it begins with C and it involves people being ill. It's been more about problems with that than problems on the border because of Brexit. You know, the couple of customers that I deal with that do import and export to Europe, yeah, they have had things to do, but again, they haven't had problems necessarily. I think the biggest issue has been that, we have suppliers who are marking their goods as manufactured in the EU, and somebody somewhere at government has said it must have the country of origin, not EU. So, you know, of all the problems that I'm seeing with my customers importing and exporting, that seems to be the biggest one, is that we're having to try and establish exactly what country a part was manufactured in to be able to import it. And that, Gareth, to be honest, seems fairly small fry, really.
Gareth, what do your customers, is there anyone who deals with foodstuffs or perishables?
No, so interesting, not dealing with anything on that.
Okay.
Yeah, no, we're electronic components, but mainly.
Okay. All right. Without getting into the specifics of the logistical issues of the deal, or I don't know. Yeah, the deal. I was going to be disparaging. Yeah. I'm sure we can dive back into that. Bruce, you're part of the people, yes, as you said, who are, is it fair to say, extremely upset by...
Yeah, I think to say that. I think it's fair to say that. It was. I suffer from mental health problems as it is, and I would say that Brexit has contributed, or the thought and the idea of it have contributed to it quite significantly over the past 4.5 years, and you know, to the point where I may have been unreasonable at certain points and things like that. And I
so
would
wait,
say
wait
that,
a second, has it been 3.5 years already? 4.5 years?
Well, since the Brexit, what was 2016?
Jeez, you're right, of course. It was the year of Donald Trump got elected to the US. So
it was, we voted for Brexit and America said we can do one better.
so let me expand on, I don't want to pry.
No, go ahead.
But since you brought it up, obviously this is a personal problem, but how does Brexit, you know?
If we're going to go, if we're going to personal, what I'll, I grew up in a country that was secluded and had sanctions. So we were excluded, and there was great pride in being Rhodesian and being separate from, you know, the rest of the world, and everything Zimbabwean was always thing, and it created
just
a very
to clarify for people who might not know, you grew up in Zimbabwe.
Yeah, sorry, I grew up in Zimbabwe, and it created a society that was very insular. And while there was all this pride and patriotism, I'm seeing now, especially in my peers, that there's a lot of misplaced pride. There's a lot of a kind of arrogance that's not that I'm not comfortable with, and I don't think is right. And it's also resulted in the country then turning in on itself. And we could blame Mugabe, and we could blame all sorts of things. But you know, Robert Mugabe is. When he came into power, he was very much like Boris Johnson. He was a popular leader, and he'd led a proper war for liberation, not some fake one that's happened in the UK here. So there are parallels there that sort of saying, well, you know, we're asking for things, but do we really want them? And that's what I've always said. It's I hate to quote JLM Brack, but you know. You think you want it, but you don't. So that's been my stance, and whether it's correct or not is another question. But that's how I've always felt. So
I mean, famously, Brack recanted because he realized that he was wrong about that specific statement. So I don't know if that's the one you want to use.
Well, I still think classic's a mistake, but that's a different discussion altogether.
Okay, I would fight you on that, and I was on the "you think you want it, but you don't" camp. But yeah, I don't think we can equate World of Warcraft Classic with.
I think it's split the player base. But anyway, I think there's a lot of yes, and he did recant it, and that's not lost on me. So I think there are parts of Brexit that I think you know that. As we've been looking at it, that could have been beneficial, and there's still ways that it can be, and that's where we have to look now. And I could sit here and you know I'm one for Schadenfreude. I sit here and talk about the lorry drivers who had their ham sandwiches taken away from them at the border in Holland.
Holland, yeah.
Yeah, which is quite funny.
What is that?
Yeah. Lorry drivers driving into Holland, they were doing their usual deliveries. They were stopped by the Dutch customs officers, and the customs officers said, you can't bring any meat or foodstuffs. Meat and dairy into the EU. So you're going to have to hand over your sandwiches, that you know. So they had to hand over their sandwiches, and they asked, you know, can we keep our bread? At least, and the customs officer said, no, sorry, welcome to Brexit. That was his exact words. So, you know, it's a petty things like that, which I think we all realize are petty. To things like there is...
Can I for just a second, I will say, obviously, this is incredibly petty. It's also kind of like the letter of the law, but it does reflect a little bit of the feeling that I think is common inside the EU, which is obviously it's not the lorry driver's fault, unless those specific ones voted for Brexit, but it's like you wanted to leave. Like this is your doing. Yep. You abandoned us. You abandoned us. So we don't have to make it any easier for you. And this is the petty, like, obviously we're going to work with the UK and we're going to make it as good as possible now that this is the situation. But there is this residual feeling of you left, you know, you wanted a divorce. So we're not going to, it's not for us to make it easy for you.
I think that's always going to be the case with any sort of separation though, isn't it? And I think as the party that's leaving, you have to accept that there will be this as a consequence. There will be an amount of animosity. Mm. There will be an amount of, well, you know, you went, so now you've got to put up with it. Mm-hmm. That might be making it being slightly flippant, but...
No.
You know, that's... We as the British people or as the UK or the UK government have to expect an amount of that. Mm-hmm. And hopefully over time, that levels out and becomes less of a sticking point or less of an issue, you know, over time, hopefully.
I agree there, and I think there's an issue here when it comes to the rhetoric of the British government. Is a lot of the times now, Michael Gove came out and said the British people, I wish I was 21 again so I could go out there and you know, rule. I said something about conquer and all that, and I think that's very dangerous post Brexit now, because Britain can survive on trade and on there's a big need within India, Africa, different parts of Africa, obviously, and other parts of the world. You know, we're talking Canada, USA, Australia, where exchange of knowledge. So the UK has great universities and job opportunities for people in those countries, and I think they will see this as, if Britain wants to be a true cosmopolitan country, then what they've got to do is ironically open up the borders to the world, say, look, come, you can come study in the country, you can come work here, and we'll take trade the goods that you have. So it's no longer a case of we're going to go there and conquer India. What we're going to do is we're going to conquer the world through trade. A lot like, I hate to say it, a lot like China have done. They're very much taking over Africa through trade. At least they were in Zimbabwe a few years ago, from what I remember. So there's an irony in that, in closing our borders to Europe, the one way to survive is opening our borders to the rest of the world.
Well, that's necessary. Like, you can't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I know Gareth, as someone who voted for Brexit and someone who is, you know, more enlightened than I think a lot of us Remainers would think a lot of Brexit voters would be, will understand that. And you'll probably agree with it. Yeah, that's a good thing to do. But I do wonder if this is something that was lost on a lot of the people who did vote for Brexit, and understanding that being a sovereign nation, which we were already, by the way, before Brexit, there was no loss of sovereignty, will rely on us having to make concessions to other countries that we haven't had to before.
That's part of the way we look at it. Something my wife has been saying is, it's going to be really interesting to see what happens when the British go and negotiate a trade deal with India. It's like, hey, so we would like, and I wonder what Gareth would say to this, but it's like, when you look at it, what does the UK alone have to offer India? And without even taking into consideration the history between the two countries, it's, what exactly are you going to put in the balance in the trade deal? I don't, you know, it, anyway, I mean, it's not like there's nothing, but there's definitely an imbalance there. And that's something that keeps coming back when you think of any country of importance. Are those trade deals going to work? Which is part of the reason why we think the EU is a good thing. It's because you put in common all of the, you know, the entire population and manufacturing capabilities and cultural productions, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't know.
I mean, I guess, but my logic there would be that, you know, India has a relatively large manufacturing base. I mean, you know, this is not my area of expertise, but as far
sure,
as
it isn't mine either, to be fair.
Yeah, you know, India manufactures quite a lot of stuff. We buy quite a lot of stuff, so we would be looking to buy things from India. Are you talking about what the UK would have to offer India back?
Yeah, and the market is part of that, but the market in the UK alone, I don't think is very large. You know, India doesn't have to... trade negotiations, and again, this isn't my area of expertise either, but it's like, okay, we're going to negotiate a deal. The beginning is like 50-50 in the power balance. And then we see what each of us, how much we can press on that balance to tip the scales in our favor, and how much the rates are going to be, and et cetera, et cetera. If the trade deal doesn't happen with the UK for India, it's like, yeah, we'll lose a little bit of, you know, income from what you would have bought, but we'll survive. Whereas if it's the entire EU negotiating, India does want to sell stuff to the EU if they're manufacturing stuff, which is not necessarily the case currently, not that much. But I don't know. It's just like it's dumb. I'm not even being very clever when I say this. It's just, oh, I wonder how it's going to go.
Yeah, but I think that, you know, India, I presume, have a trade deal with Australia. I don't know what the population of Australia is compared to the UK. I'm assuming it's larger.
Oh, it's definitely smaller. It's like 30 million Australia. Let's check. But yeah, no, of course they have a trade deal. I'm sure. Although I wonder if Australia isn't part of some bigger organization. Australian listeners, apologies. But yeah. Anyway, that was just, you know, a side thing. Let's get back to Bruce and the, you know, the effect on your... Oh, it's 25 million. Wow. Just, I said 30 out of my behind, and it's not so far off.
Well, then.
Yes.
So, yeah.
And yet...
Bruce.
I think, yeah, you know, there are lots of things around trade deals that I think are far outside of what any of us here understand. So I think, you know, I'm more hopeful on that. I am a bit worried about some of the stuff that's coming out in the press about the fishing sector. And I know we've spoken about this, but it was a big thing that was being discussed prior to the deal being made. Apparently it was one of the sticking points. And I know a lot of the fish that have been now being caught in British waters, the EU are now not accepting it, so it's being left to rot because it's the right documents haven't been filled in, and the necessary trade arrangements for that type of foodstuff haven't been fulfilled by the UK fishermen. Now, I don't necessarily think this is the politicians' fault, ultimately. It's one of those things, and this is becoming a very regular thing that I'm saying here, is we've had 11 months of transition, and there are a lot of people who haven't seemed to have fully grasped the idea of what's going to need to happen after you know, once post Brexit. This is a soft, you know, this is essentially a soft deal. We are still abiding by EU rules and regulations. I don't know if many people realize that. Yes, we've got a deal, but actually, if we vary too much from them, we're going to have to renegotiate everything. So, yes, okay, we have our sovereignty with it. But what hasn't happened is that the fishing community, a lot of them have not read up on what they need to do. They don't know the documents, so a lot of fish have been lost. And particularly, I've heard, and you're going to laugh, Patrick, we talk about but French officials have turned away whole consignments because the Latin names of the fish are spelled incorrectly in the documents. And, you know, I think this is where pettiness has. I would say that is petty, as much as I am very much for the remain or for rejoining. I think that's a bit much. But there's a situation now where we have these things happening where you sort of say, well, you've had a year to sort yourselves out. And this goes for expats in Spain, British people who live in Spain, who now realizing, oh, we can only live here 90 days of the year. They didn't realize that before.
Oh, did they not?
They're all finding out now.
Okay, that's a bit weird. I would say they need to get a visa if they want to stay longer, and that's not impossible to do. But I'm going to precede Gareth here, and I'm guessing that what he's going to say is, well, that's to be expected in the first few months of the thing when there's a big change like this. The fishermen are not going to fill the right papers, but it will get sorted out, right? That's not... Like, yeah. what I'm hearing, Bruce, and
yes,
is, I don't want to say nitpicky, but it's small yeah. things. And keep yeah. in mind, I would not have wanted the UK to leave. Like, that is absolutely not my preference. I resent all of you a little bit for leaving us, as I was saying before. But at the same, you what, Garrett?
We still love you.
Ah, oh, that's the right answer. Thank you.
Just you in particular.
I'll take it. I'm selfish. I don't mind. But the impression was, you know, as often is in these cases, it's going to be the end of the world. When you were yeah. listening to people from, and it's no. obviously it was an exaggeration, but you're saying that some fish rotted or rot somewhere yeah. in a fishing port, like yeah. and some rich retirees can't spend all their time in Spain without asking for a visa.
Yeah.
It's not very world end of world-y. Like, it's not
no.
it's not armed militia entering the capital, if you see what I mean. Like, it's not even that level of
no. But what you see, what I'm seeing is that although these issues are relatively small, there's a cumulative effect. And yeah. the media is sort of jumping on some of these things and blowing them up. And oh, the government didn't give the fishermen the paperwork they needed.
Yeah.
So bad government. But actually, the fishermen didn't go and find the paperwork that they needed. They didn't bother checking. They didn't, you know, that there are lots of other reasons that these fish are now sitting there rotting away.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a well, okay, first of all, let me say when I got the call to this podcast, I thought, right, okay, I'm gonna look everything up, I'm gonna figure out all the bad stuff that's happened, and I'm gonna lay it on, and Garrett's gonna be completely, and you know what, all I found were these things, and I'm thinking, okay, well, so I agree with you. I think you know, there's a situation, and we're also, and we can't hide from the elephant in the room. COVID has had a big, big impact on everything. And Gareth alluded to earlier, we don't necessarily know right now if the negative consequences that are happening are directly Brexit related. And I don't think we'll know for a long time. Mm. The catastrophe that many, I may have been in that group, I don't remember, you know, who many prophesized hasn't happened, and that's great. And I have to give the government, the UK government, some credit in getting something through. I was convinced we were going to have a no deal the whole of last year, and that would have been bad. But we've got something through, and there are still things to work out. The Northern Ireland and Ireland thing, I'm still a bit confused about, and I would have liked Bart's view on that. But I think as far as scenarios go, we're not actually in the worst case. At least we don't have people storming Westminster. Oops.
It feels a little bit like the real tragedy is almost more of a philosophical one. It's like we don't there's something that hit me really hard, because one of the most enriching things that I've had in my life was traveling, and especially as a young person, going to different countries and seeing different cultures and different people, which in many ways led to this show I'm doing now. And the Erasmus program now doesn't include the UK anymore. For those who don't know, the Erasmus program is a school exchange program that had children from all over Europe travel and spend a year in a different country. And it was especially heartening because you would have young, you know, French kids spending a year in a friendly German family 50 years after their grandfathers or even fathers tried to kill each other. And that was, you know, something that is very, very precious. It's all, it all has to do with the fragility of peace and democracy that I think we've had for so long, peace and democracy, that we forget how fragile they are. But it's kind of those high-level I don't know, like not regrets because it's, but do you see what I mean? Like, does it make sense? It feels like it's more that that is tragic.
The Erasmus program is something that that I remember I was reading about, and what has been said is that they're going to replace it with something that's more inclusive of the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, if that happens, great. I'm all for it. I'm all for especially people in the UK discovering new cultures and people from different areas who've had different experiences, because I think there's a lot to be gained from that. Mm. So, as, like I was saying earlier, that the if somehow the UK can maneuver itself and be trusted again, because that's a big one. We lost a lot of trust through the whole Brexit process. Then I think there's hope.
Mm. And that's not what
the catastrophe.
That's not what I was expecting to be the.
I'm being as positive as I can be, but mm-hmm. I'm not confident the UK government is able to do it, at least in its current form. Mm-hmm. And I think, like America, we need to have a long, hard look at ourselves and our democratic process, and say, right, let's sort our house out now.
I mean,
and I think that needs to be the focus.
Why democratic process? It was entirely democratic. How was it, except for the lies of the people who were campaigning, but that's not, you know,
I think that the referendum aside, I think the mistake was made years ago when the Tory government got in place, and when UKIP became a threat. Oh, I don't want to go too much into it, but basically the Tory party, the vote was set up as a reaction to UKIP and as a way of not losing voters to UKIP. Mm-hmm. So that's the UK Independence Party, which Nigel Farage was at the head at. Now, they had members in the European Parliament, because the way the voting system works there is different to how the first-past-the-post system works.
Mm.
I firmly believe that if we had a proportional representational system, we would have had more UKIP members within our own government, and there would have been more of a debate mm-hmm. and understanding of the situation, as opposed to the Brexit vote we got, which was plagued with all sorts of issues. So I think the first past the post system that we have at the moment is, it needs to go. What we need to happen is for us to get a proportional representation, for people to have a government they actually voted for, as opposed to a government that just happened to be there because of the way the borders are aligned.
I think proportionality is incredibly important, and it sounds a little bit counterintuitive when you to people who don't really, you know, hear of it the first time. But you're right. It's maybe a different.
I wouldn't necessarily disagree with any of what you've just said. I don't necessarily fully agree, but I don't necessarily think that the way that we do elect our officials currently works. You know, I have a big problem with parties generally and people voting on party lines rather than on what they believe or their constituents believe is the best thing.
Mm. I agree with you there. That's another issue we desperately need to look at.
All right, so I would like to shift to the second part, which we're probably not going to spend as much time on, but I'm wondering, long term, both of you, let's start with Gareth, let's say 10 years out, what do you want to happen, or maybe those are two interesting questions, let's do it like that. What would you want realistically to happen, and like, it's not pie in the sky thing, like if everything was perfect. And also, what do you think will actually happen to and in the UK following Brexit? Gareth.
So I kind of hope that things like the Erasmus stuff, I hope that we do not end up in a situation where we do not accept students from outside of the UK to come and study in the UK, because that would be bad. That would be terrible. And I don't think that for me personally, that's not certainly not one of the things that I want as an outcome from Brexit. So I hope that that continues, and that actually as we were mentioning earlier, that we end up accepting students from more countries, so not just Europe. Let's, you know, why not accept students from anywhere on the planet? Anywhere outside of the
planet. It seems that would be a you know, an easy thing to accomplish. It doesn't seem like the most challenging one.
No. And that we end up with good, you know, in inverted commas, because good's a very subjective term, but good trade deals with any country that we need to have a good trade deal with. There should be nothing that stops any country on the planet from dealing with the UK, and similarly from the UK dealing with any other country. And I don't think that's, whilst it's complicated, I don't think that's unachievable either.
How is it different? Like, more specifically, I would like to know how being outside of the EU is going to improve the situation in the UK, in your opinion, because that's not, you know, you're talking about recreating things that were in place as a part of the EU. So, yeah,
the difference, I guess, from that point is that the UK is getting to make those agreements with those individual parties rather than those decisions being made for the UK by the EU.
And those decisions are going to be better made, you mean? How is that an advantage?
They will be made in the interests of the British people rather than in the interests of Europe as a whole.
Can you give me a second. I'll get back to you, Bruce in a second. Mm-hmm. Can you give me a specific example of how that would improve? And I'm sure you have many, but... I don't know that I do, honestly. Oh, really? That's concerning, Gareth, because it would be something that you need to have a clear vision on if you're going to exit the EU. If you don't know specifically how that would be improved, it becomes, oh, but I've heard that, you know, things aren't great for the UK.
I think one of the things that I said very early on was that part of my problem, and please excuse the use of the word problem, but part of my problem with Europe was the multiple levels of bureaucracy. So local government in the, in counties in the UK, and then national government, and then going up to Europe. And I would actually feel happier if we, no, not happier. I would be almost as happy if we said, you know what, we're just going to do away with the UK government. Let's just have a Europe government. We'll do away with some of these units in between.
So you felt that the layers of administrative whatever were impeding the establishing of rules and laws in the interest of the specific people.
Yes, absolutely, and I very much feel that that's the case within the UK as well. So, as I said just a few minutes ago, we have this issue where my local member of parliament doesn't actually live anywhere near the constituency that he represents. He doesn't actually have any idea what's going on the ground within his constituency, and he doesn't really know what the people within his constituency want. But he's a member of the Conservative Party, and therefore he votes with the Conservative Party.
Do you feel that's bettered by the UK not being part of the EU?
That specific disconnect, no, but it draws everything sort of one level in. So that's a very sort of localized issue, but it became bigger and bigger the bigger the organizational unit got. So you start looking at people making decisions in Europe, they are so much further removed from a person that lives in Stone in Staffordshire in the UK.
Yeah, I think that's a fair sentiment, and that's a sentiment that is shared by everyone everywhere. My reaction would be, but you get other advantages that outweigh these issues, but I can understand what. Yeah, okay.
I think government needs to follow an economy of scale. So I don't think a one world government. I used to think one world government would solve it all. The situation you have there is that you would ultimately have one one person calling all the shots, and I don't think that's a good thing. I think America was on the way to figuring out a good system with its federal system. It just didn't go far enough. And I think the EU was the closest we've got to it, in that the way the EU was set up was more of a necessary bureaucratic system. What they did was they took all the bureaucracies within the laws and the regulations, and they brought it into one place and said, right, let's just make it all one thing so we don't have to redo this every single time we, you know, if a truck goes from France all the way to Czechoslovakia, it doesn't need to go through 400 different checks. That's one part of the EU. And another thing that I think I need to push back on is the idea that the EU was a bureaucratic thingy. I don't think the EU should be saying you can't, you know, replace the windows in the local church hall. I think that's a local issue that needs to be sorted out by local people. But there's also a need for them to say, well, actually, you can't build it out of asbestos because it's dangerous, you know. And that's where a more unified system, and then laws and regulations. It's complicated. I'm trying to remember what I said I would come back on earlier with what Gareth was saying.
You were talking about the Gareth was talking about the administration issues,
when it comes to the British, the EU making laws and regulations that weren't British, and this is something I've said, and I don't really want to go into it because it sounds like I'm being petty with the thing, but what I don't have the exact statistics to hand, but Britain only ever voted against any of the regulations brought up by the EU something like less than 1% of the time. And Britain did have a veto. It could exercise a veto and said no. They were in a situation, a position of power to say, actually, we don't want that. And all of the other 27 countries would have to go suck it. Britain was in a position of power in that way. And I keep going back to when we talk about immigration, this is a big one. Immigration, oh, it's a big problem. Actually, within the EU legislation, there was the ability for the British government, if it had the balls, to put into place regulations that would have curbed immigration from the EU to an extent that would have appeased the hard right. So, you know, there were opportunities there that the UK government did not take. And I guess going back to what, I don't know if Gareth's finished now, but if we're going on to what we're hoping for or what we're looking for in the future, I don't think what we're hoping for, what's going to happen are going to be the same thing in any way.
So what
am I hoping for,
and what do you think is going to happen?
Well, we can all hold hands and sing.
No, I'm saying realistic. I mean, on this show, we would do that, obviously. But
I think realistically, if the UK can actually, no, you know what I'm hoping for is that Scotland has another vote for independence, and it gets it. And I mean, in an ideal world, I would love Scotland to become part of Scandinavia and mm-hmm. part of the EU in that way. And there's already
before, yeah.
Yeah, there's already, incidentally, there was talk, I don't know how serious it was, of Scotland adopting the krona, which would be very interesting indeed. So, you know, there are things around that. Now,
no, but this is definitely not pie in the sky. It's been talked
it's
about
not
a
pie
few
in the
times.
Sky.
Do you think it, you're hoping it will happen. Do you think it will?
I think it's not within the not outside the realms of possibility. It's like the idea of a united Ireland is being spoken about now. And this, again, like I said, I would have wanted to hear what Bart had to say mm-hmm. there, because I hear the DUP are very unhappy with what's happened with the whole the DUP are the hard right Northern Irish party who propped up the UK government back in 2016 and 17, and they got promptly stabbed in the back. What's going to happen? I don't know, Patrick. And I have to say that now, ever since the 2019 vote, when the Tories got in with a landslide, pretty much, I don't know. COVID is throwing a huge, huge wrench into the thing. And in the UK here at the moment, I don't know how much you know, but it's running rampant. I'm very lucky, and where I live is actually the, I suppose, in inverted commas, safest place to be, because our COVID rates are the lowest in the whole of the UK. In fact, I'm going into a meeting after this around, you know, the what we're putting in place and how we're supporting it. But I don't know. Is America going to blow up? You know, I hope not. I hope they get somebody sensible in, but I don't necessarily think Biden's going to be the panacea there. I don't think he's going to unite the people. And that's what we need. We need leaders who can unite and not be divisive. And that's going to be the difficult thing.
I mean, I think the unification of Ireland would be a fairly obvious consequence of Brexit. Whether it's the right thing for the Northern Irish people or for the Irish people, I don't know. But it would be an obvious knock-on effect, I think.
But Gareth, like, if that happens, let's say 5 years from now, Ireland, Northern Ireland has left the UK, Scotland has left the UK, wouldn't you look at it and be like, wouldn't you think the UK has been diminished by Brexit? Would you be okay with just like having half of the, I don't know how it's called, like states or nations that were in the, it would be just you and poor old Wales.
Yeah, I think, I don't know how I would feel, honestly. Mm. I think it would depend how that would impact my ability to go visit those places.
Oh, you could always visit. That's not. Yeah, but no. The Brexit is not about visiting. Brexit, unless I misunderstand, it's about the, if we push the levers on description a little bit, the grandeur of the country, right? Isn't that like, because you can't decide for yourself and you're diminished by the impositions that aren't appropriate that the EU is doing on you, and you're not great again, essentially. Like, there was a time when the UK could soar, and with these trade deals that we're going to negotiate ourselves, it's going to be just like, you know, when we were amazing.
I think that's possibly political speak that's trying to get the hard right on board. You know, I'm very much not of the close the borders, stop anyone coming in.
Oh,
stop,
I don't think that's, you know,
let's amass the army and go, you know, go take back the colonies. That's absolutely not sort of where I'm coming from. And whether I mean that in a physically let's go back and take the colonies or in a trade deal, let's go and retake the colonies, I'm not entirely sure. But I sort of feel that actually, if Scotland decided that Scotland wanted to be apart from the UK, it would be incredibly hypocritical of anybody within the UK who voted for Brexit to say, no,
of course, but that's still, I don't know. You know, so one issue I have now is that I'm not sure I understand what Brexit is, how Brexit is improving stuff. Like, there's this vague idea that decisions, you know, the what you mentioned, Gareth, the less layers of administration, which that I completely understand the idea of it, but this is very vague, and I don't see what's, you know, in the US at least, which obviously the situation in the US has been, I think, in the past few days worse, but Like, they want specific things. Like, they want no more immigration. They want manufacturing to come back to the U.S. They want, stopping interventionism in outside of the country. They don't want to be the cop of the world anymore. I don't think they're right. I think they're misguided in many of those things. But at least I understand how they think that drastic policy change would improve their, maybe not daily lives, but standing in the world. In the case of, situation of the country. In the case of Brexit, I do not understand how anything is improved by the UK being outside of the EU. Like, practically, outside of the administrative consideration.
I think for me, that is the main part. It's giving the UK the ability to make its own decisions and to not have to do that through a third party that is then so much more removed from the people that are actually on the ground.
Mm. And hopefully that improves the decisions that are made that fit the actual issues that you're facing better.
Yes, absolutely. You know, that the benefit for me is that the decisions will be made more locally, and therefore those decisions should be more in line with what people want. But at the same time, I acknowledge that that's not necessarily the case right now.
I want to ask one last question to Gareth, and then we'll go to you, Bruce, and then we'll close off the show. But can you then, Gareth, give me an example of how decisions that were made within the EU, like, overseeing body were detrimental to you or even beyond that?
I can't give you any specific examples.
Okay.
Give me a minute. Talk to Bruce. Let me just have a think about
that.
Okay. I think there's an element of I think it being a bit I'm going to say this necessarily. I think at the point now it doesn't matter, and it might not be fair to be asking Gareth those questions right now, because it's not where we need to be. Where we need to be is saying, right, this is where we are. I don't personally think our lives are going to be better because of leaving the EU. Now, our lives could get better, but I don't think it's going to be because of EU leaving it. I think it's going to be in spite of it. Mm. I think there was a lot of rhetoric within the election itself around just what the EU controlled and what it didn't control. I think there could have been better communication around what it does. For me, looking at the EU and understanding it, it was basically a central place to say, let's just get our regulations right. Let's just get our basic laws in place. The British government's already turned around and said, well, maybe those labor laws we had, you know, that the EU instructed on us, maybe we'll turn those around. I hope they don't, but there's already talk within it. It's being covered up now by the US elections. In fact, it was on Wednesday the 6th when the US seditious situation began that the Tory member said that. And to me, that's very much from my youth. The Mugabe government would always announce something that would be unpopular just as something within the world would take its away the heat. So in years' time, you could say, "But you never told us." No, we did. We did. We did tell you. We told you on this day, and you didn't.
Political trick for years, though.
Yeah. So, and I think it worries me if the Tory government, and this is a point, and I think this is what I was going to say earlier, is I agree with Gareth very much. We need a government, and we need a situation where the people's voices are being heard, and I don't think a majority Tory government is what the people want. It's what we voted for. It doesn't necessarily mean it's what we want, because the policies and the way they... You might have a very good Tory minister within your section, within your council area, and you vote him in. And just as Gareth has said, whether you be in the EU or not in the EU, he's going to vote along Tory lines. He's not going to come back and say, well, what do we want on this situation? Find out what the population wants and then go back and fight for them. He's going to vote along popular Tory lines because there's a whip, there's a system in place, there's a hierarchy. And if you're just a lowly backbencher, if you don't vote the way the party votes, you're going to be out on your ear. So there are problems there. There are problems there, and it's not necessarily the EU's fault for those problems. And it might actually be better in the long run for the UK to sort them out themselves and then come back and try and get a more equitable place in the world and not have this idea that... And this is the other thing with Gareth. I don't think you're representing Gareth very well here, and in that he's not the Brexit voter who was touting and standing up and saying, you know, we want to make our country great again. Gareth, I'm putting words in your mouth, but what I'm hearing is somebody who just wants to be able to have control politically of your life and the things that matter to you. And I'm the same. We just believe in different systems. So it would be interesting to have a hard-line far-right Brexit voter. You on know, this podcast.
Maybe, yes. The reason I'm grilling Gareth the way I am, which I hope is still, you know, kind enough, is that Brexit has now happened after 4 years of whatever the last 4 years were. And even though I've talked about it with many people and read about it to some extent, I still don't understand what it was for. And that's an issue. I think it's a fair, and I'm not in the UK, but I think that's a fair thing to wonder about. And, so
I,
you know,
what I would say, it sort of attempting to answer the previous question. I think that when I made the decision on how I was going to vote, I had a clear reason in my head for doing that.
Okay.
But I also think that I've slept several times since then, and I struggle to remember what I had for breakfast yesterday, let alone the decision-making process from a vote 3.5-4 years ago.
Right.
But what I would say is that the decision that I made at the time was based on the information that I had available to me, and I felt it was the right decision at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There have been things since that actually, had I been asked to vote since then, I might actually have voted the other way.
Mm. And I think one of the most enlightening things that I got from you, actually, Gareth, a couple of years ago was... I had this image of this very strong pro or con, pro or against Brexit with like a very, I don't know, fiery reasoning behind it. And what you said was like, listen, I was just asked a question and I voted as I was asked to do. That's what happened. It's not like, you know, and I think that might describe a lot of people in a way that many people who are outside of it wouldn't expect. I don't know, but
yeah, that's a reasonable assessment, I think, of and I'm sorry, that's my doorbell going, even though there's a note on my door that says delivery drivers, please.
Maybe it's important. We'll conclude the show. Maybe you want to go answer it, but we'll conclude the show with Bruce. And
I think it's worth noting that the most heartbreaking thing to me is, yes, Brexit's a bad thing, but is that we never had a second vote. We never had a confirmatory, legally binding vote. The vote that happened in 2016 was advisory. It only ever was advisory, and it wasn't legally binding in any way, and it has been used for political purposes to push through this agenda. And it's sad. It's sad because British people have lost a lot of trust throughout the world, and it needs to be built back now, and that's the challenge. And I think we need to look forward and not have blame and recriminations. And I think you told me this about a year ago. You know, we need to move together, and not it's done, it's gone, it's in the past. And so we can't blame, and I can't be asking those questions. What you're asking now, Patrick, was exactly what I've been asking for four and a half years, and I never had an answer that satisfied me, and that's why I'm still firmly in the Remain camp. But there we go. Okay. Yes, final. Yeah, that's me.
Okay.
Not awful anymore.
maybe in 10 years time we should revisit the situation. You know, we should put it up for a vote again. Do we think that we should rejoin?
I mean, let me tell you, Gareth, I don't know what's going to happen in 10 years' time, but you will get a significantly worse deal than you already had if you ask to rejoin in 10 years.
I don't think any British government's ever going to ask for a referendum ever again.
That's it. Nothing, ever.
Nothing.
I don't know. I mean, obviously, I think the bonds of history and culture are too strong for me to say that the UK would not be welcomed back into the EU. But it is like that. This is not where we are right now. And we're rational. Like, the UK is a big part of what makes Europe. So I'm sure we would discuss it. But I don't know, for example, like, if we're talking about very specific administrative stuff, I'm pretty sure you wouldn't get the veto power that you had.
I mean, you know, we had that sort of thing because we were
founding members and
original members. Yeah, so, but I mean, maybe in maybe not in 10 years, but maybe in 20 years, Europe will want to join the UK and become part of the United Kingdom and North America, including Scandinavia, alliance.
You know, someone tweeted something which means that I should be very cautious about laughing about this. Like, a couple of days ago, someone said, if in the 90s someone had told me that Arnold Schwarzenegger would be talking about a seditious militia coup attempt in his governor's outfit in his office, brandishing the Conan the Barbarian sword and all of this, and talking about his, you know, Austrian origins, I would not have believed it. Fairly, that was, you know, understandable. So who knows what's going to happen in 30 years? Who knows, really?
Who, like, this, wasn't Hitler Austrian?
Indeed.
I believe he was, yeah.
I mean, okay, he was born in Austria, question. But... Yeah,
but very quick question. I've been reading a bit about the French elections and French political situation, and apparently there are, and I don't know how true this is, there is growing support for France leaving the EU too. Frexit is what they want to call it. But I don't know if you've heard anything about that, if that's just underground stuff and just not true.
It is a political current that exists, but in the last election, it lost significant ground because the idea was very unpopular, or maybe not very unpopular, but was unpopular even in the far right's camp. And the main representative of the far right, Marine Le Pen, had to abandon the idea of saying, you know, she didn't brandish it as a policy that she would implement if she was elected president. She actually said, no, we would stay in the EU. So while it does exist as an idea, I think in the past few years it has been very much diminished, and it's not something that is in any way realistic at this point.
Okay.
So...
Why would you vote, Patrick, if given the choice? I'm joking.
Remain or leave?
Yeah.
You know, I think the EU does have issues. That is obvious.
Yeah.
Every organization has issues, and every political organization has issues. I think one of the problems that we have as a people now, I think there are a couple of problems. I can't remember if I was saying this on the show, but we have forgotten how tenuous democracy and peace are, which is a big problem. You know, that's our parents were, or maybe not parents, but grandparents were killing each other, and they were neighbors. And it is very difficult to maintain peace as we have in the past 70 years. And I think it's in part because we have those interwoven economical interests and cultural interests, and kids going to study in those neighboring countries. That's one problem. Another problem is that we think politicians are crap. And that is a horrendous way of thinking about your country, because politicians and civil servants do an incredibly boring and difficult job. Administrations run countries, and that is not sexy. And yes, the, you know, annoying side effect is that sometimes you get told that you can't water your plants the way you want to because some regulation tells you that this thing is bad or whatever. But that's the side thing. The main thing is this entire gigantic machine that runs properly at peace and allows you to buy a safe piece of fruit that has been farmed on the other side of the world and that you can eat without fearing you're going to catch some deadly disease. Because all of this machinery works, and it's the tireless, thankless, annoying job of the people who are pushing pencils in those offices that make sure these things work. And we think that it's that they decide what they do and what I do in my own home. And the politicians are all corrupted and they're all in it for themselves and they all vote along party lines. We have a system that works the best any system has ever worked anywhere in the history of humanity. And we're criticizing it and deciding that it's crap because we have to put a label on a piece of fruit. Like that. So, yes, Gareth, I would vote to stay in the EU. And also, everyone should read Factfulness. I've been saying this for a little while. Just read Factfulness. You think the world doesn't work. And yes, there are issues that Hans Rosling does talk about in Factfulness. He doesn't shy away from them. You have no idea how well the world is doing because we're all caught in that insane conspiracy theory that we've inflicted upon ourselves that the world isn't working. It's crazy what we're thinking about how things are going. It's ridiculous. Read Factfulness, please, everyone.
I just Googled Factfulness because I don't know it, but I will add that to my reading list.
I would love to talk to you about it after you've read it, Gareth.
I will chuck it on my Audible list and have a listen. You know, I mean, everything you've just said, you know, makes perfect sense. Yes, we, you know, the political landscape that we are in now, as you say, is pretty damn stable as compared to any other time in history. And yes, maybe we shouldn't be picking fault with the label that I have to peel off my apple if the fact of the label being there means that I don't die of botulism. that's definitely a plus if you put it in that context.
I just want to add one thing, Patrick, to what you're saying, is that we have a system that's working, but what we need to do is make sure we're always vigilant and looking for ways to improve it, because I think in the UK and in the US in particular, the system the systems aren't working. It took Biden 7 million extra votes to just pit past the post and win the presidency. If he'd lost 400,000 votes, he would not. He would have 6.5 million more votes, but he would not have become president of the United States because of the system they have in place. I think democracy is good, but I think there are forms of democracy that have been used to manipulate and get certain people into. I think the UK is a good example of that with the first past the post, and the American system with primaries and all of that. I won't go into it, but I think it breeds extremism on both ends. The way it works there. So I think it needs to be changed. It doesn't need to be scrapped. It just needs to be changed.
Absolutely. I'm not saying everything is perfect. And actually, that's one of the core tenets of the Church of Factfulness is the fact that it's good doesn't mean it can't be improved. And we should always look at ways of improving things. And that is absolutely something that he says very, very clearly and details. The U.S. does have a significant issue, I believe. I don't think it's the Electoral College. I would say the bigger issue is the first past the post thing with no two turns elections, which would allow other parties to and other opinions to be heard, and thus the two main parties to, you know, have to take those into account. I think that is, but, you know, that's a different
conversation.
That's a
discussion for another day.
Yeah, but I completely agree. I will add, however, something I'm sure we'll talk about in the next show. I think a lot of people are looking at the U.S. and seeing a fledgling, not a fledgling, threatened democracy, a democracy that is hanging by a thread. I think this could not be further from the truth.
Yeah.
I think what actually happened was a staggering attempt at subverting democracy, and 90% of the systems and institutions that were put in place to protect it working. Everything worked. The vote worked. The judicial system worked. The legislative system worked. The media system worked. Everything worked because it is such a strongly built democracy. And I'm sure people looking at it now are a little bit too close to the issues and maybe are seeing only the horrendous things that we've seen with the invasion of the Capitol. And I agree. And we're still very worried about what might happen in a week at the inauguration. But at this point, what happened isn't a democracy on its way out. It's a democracy built so solidly that someone that has been working for 4 years at eroding it with immense popularity and I would argue deceiving of the population didn't manage. Because the police, the military, the judicial, the media, all of the institutions worked. So I don't think the democracy, and even Brexit is a sign that the democracy is working. Now, improvements, proportionality, absolutely, Bruce, I agree. But these kinds of things, I think we referenced that idea a couple of times over the past couple of years. I think these kinds of things are what leads to civil wars, 100 or 200 years ago. So.
Yeah.
Sorry, Gareth.
Yeah, I agree.
No, I was only basically going to completely agree with what you were saying. yes, I think America is the perfect example of somebody got to power, attempted to subvert the entire country, and was unable to, or has been unable to. As you say, that speaks to the strength of that democracy as opposed
to the institutions. Imagine something like that happening in any of those countries that don't have as strong institutions. Well, obviously, the first place that comes to mind is Africa and sub-Saharan Africa. That would have led to a very different outcome. And that is, anyway, all right.
and has led to a very different outcome on several occasions, obviously. I think.
Yeah. All right. Yay, democracy. That's...
In brighter news, there's no snow on the ground anymore where I am, so that means that it's easy to go out running.
Oh my God, it's still snowing here, and I don't know what we're going to do. It's basically it's snow apocalypse here in Finland. So
you don't like snow.
I mean,
why do you hate fun, Patrick?
In the next episode of the Phileas Club, we will answer that pressing question. Thank you both for being on the show today with me. Hopefully, it gives a little bit of an insight on what's happening in the UK with the fact that Brexit actually is a reality now. Where can people go if they want a little bit more from you, Bruce?
I'm on Twitter, BruceWoodward3, and I'm not posting as much as I have been recently. I'm taking a bit
taking a break from Twitter, are we? I think that's a good thing to do.
I think I've also taken a huge break from Facebook because that was driving me nuts. Mm. But yeah, you'll find me there or on the Phileas Club Discord, especially in the patron area if you want to, you know, chat. I think become a patron and we can have a chat there. So yeah, that's what
absolutely. If you want to become a patron, patreon.com/thePhileas Club, and the link is in the show notes. And we do have a private little cozy velvet area in the Discord, which is accessible to anyone, by the way. If you want to go to notpatrick.com, you'll find a link to that. But yeah, we do have a little private area where we usually have some interesting conversations. Gareth, what about you?
I do Twitter, so you can find me at Gareth Westwood. Don't get on there every day necessarily, but I do try and keep on top of that. Just to reiterate what you were just saying, I keep thinking that I need to go and create an account on Patreon and start supporting some of the fantastic content creators that I listen to, yourself being one of them, Patrick. So I think that's what I need to do when we get off this call now, is I will go and I will do that. Positive call to action there. Just go do it now.
Well, thank you very much, Gareth. Obviously, your contribution is incredibly valuable on the show, so please don't feel like you have to also give me some of your hard-earned money, which you will need in the coming, you know, years of post-Brexit terribleness. But thank you very much for the sentiment. And patreon.com/thePhileas Club. I'm Not Patrick on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, everywhere. And we'll talk to you in a few weeks for another episode of The Phileas Club. 2021 really is going to be a fantastic year. Right after we get out of the, you know, tying up of the season finale of 2020, which had a couple of things set up. Like, this is but we have a new writing team that's coming in, and it's the whole tone is going to, 2021 is going to be great, I assure you. But by the end of the year, we'll look back and we'll say, yeah, Patrick was right. I hope. Talk to you in a few weeks.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for ways to win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt, so throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.